is Thursday, October 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Florida Panhandle comes to terms with the devastation caused by Hurricane Michael.
Some people apparently made it through and their homes were fine. We're hearing other stories of people hiding in bathtubs, closets, huddled in buildings while the walls are buckling and the roofs are being torn off.
The mysterious disappearance over a Saudi Arabian journalist at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul continues to raise questions, and singer Taylor Swift wins a prestigious American Music Award. It's all ahead. Florida Governor Rick Scott promised a strong relief effort from his administration Thursday after the state was slammed by Hurricane Michael. The hurricane was the most powerful storm on record in Florida's panhandle and the third strongest on record to hit the U.S. mainland. Federal Emergency Management Agency Administrator William Brock Long said Thursday Mexico Beach, Florida, was wiped out by the storm surge, and efforts were underway to get to the teams in to assess damage. The National Hurricane Center downgraded Michael to a tropical storm early Thursday, saying its maximum winds had dropped below the threshold for a hurricane. Michael made landfall Wednesday in the Florida Panhandle with maximum sustained winds of 249 kilometers per hour, putting it just below Category 5 status that tops the scale used to describe the strength and destructive potential of hurricanes. Wendy Victoria is managing editor of the Northwest Florida Daily News. She tells me about what's known about the damage sustained in hard-hit Panama City.
We have been unable to reach officials there, and even local officials, like sheriffs in neighboring counties, have been unable to reach people in Panama City. We're understanding that there's very, very limited cell service and that power was out as of last night in 99% of the county. Some people apparently made it through and their homes were fine. We're hearing other stories of people hiding in bathtubs, closets, huddled in buildings while the walls are buckling and the roofs are being torn off. We've had a very difficult time getting information and even getting in touch with our staff members who work over there.
I believe you have a sister paper there, the Panama City News Herald. What has that building, what kind of damage has that building sustained?
Our company is still trying to reach that building. We're understanding that it's in an area that's being controlled by FEMA at the moment, so there is no access into a wide portion of Panama City. What we know is hearsay that two portions of the building, including the roofs, collapsed, or we've heard that. We, again, can't get there to see it. The door may have been blown out, and I think the room where our press room, the roof is destroyed over the press room.
And what have you learned about the area around, for instance, like the town of Apalachicola, which I think bore some of the brunt of the hurricane?
We have a reporter from our paper in Apalachicola since before the storm. We sent her over there to provide coverage for the region. We have papers stretching from Apalachicola and Port St. Joe all the way back over to Santa Rosa County. So we cover, I'm not sure what the distance is, maybe 150 miles of Florida Panhandle with all of our properties. She said Highway 98 is impassable, which is the major east-west road along the coast. There's damage, debris on the road. It's not clear how much of it is damaged, but she was unable to travel on it this morning. The main interstate that would connect Apalachicola to our area or even to Panama City, that is closed at the moment. About 80 miles of that is being closed while highway officials sort that out and figure out what's wrong with that road, if anything. I believe Apalachicola took on a great deal of water. She was in the downtown after the storm, and the businesses did take water in. There's trees down on homes. There's a lack of power. And the last that she was able to determine, some folks on islands had been cut off, and it was unclear how they were doing. There was no one was able to reach some of the people that she'd interviewed right before the storm. She was then unable to reach them the storm.
And then there have been rather dire reports about the town of Mexico Beach.
That was what we're hearing was ground zero for the storm. We have been trying to reach people in Mexico Beach. Our reporters worked into last night trying to reach out to the few people that were on any type of social media. We have not been able to reach anyone in Mexico Beach. It's a tourism stretch along the Gulf of Mexico, and we've not been able to reach anyone. It's between Franklin County, Apalachicola, where our reporter is, and Panama City, and that is where the storm came in, as well as Tyndall Air Force Base, which is one of the large Air Force bases, and they have reportedly sustained serious damage as well.
But I guess from a good news perspective, where you are, Fort Walton Beach, and also the nearby city of Destin, have made it through fairly well.
We were braced for a more of an impact, and certainly in Walton County, which is really just 20 miles away from where homes were just leveled. Walton County was braced. They were under a curfew. They were pulling fire crews off the road, as the storm was coming in. But what the people we've spoke to in Walton County, they were out and about and trying to reopen their businesses and had maybe some power outages, but the damage we saw was a torn awning and a potted plant tipped over and relatively minor damage. So Walton County is, South Walton is rocking and rolling back up largely for business, I think, as soon as their power comes back on. Destin was mostly untouched. I'm not sure if there was some beach erosion, but Destin was in great shape yesterday afternoon. And Fort Walton was, we had winds and a little bit of rain. Same with Navarre. So high surf would be the only possible remaining issue over here, but no real damage to speak of, particularly when you compare it to what happened in Panama City.
Wendy Victoria, managing editor of the Northwest Florida Daily News, speaking with me from Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Malaysia will end its death penalty and sedition act. President Trump voices optimism about the chances for the Republicans in the upcoming midterm elections. First Lady Melania Trump says she's one of the most bullied people in the world, and Africa's youngest billionaire is abducted in Tanzania. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's Cassini mission, which provided a close look of Saturn, its moons, and famous rings for 13 years, came to a blazing end on September 11, 2017. One of the highlights of the Cassini mission was the 2014 discovery of geysers spewing jets of icy water high above Saturn's moon Enceladus. A team of scientists led by the University of Heidelberg, Germany, studied data gathered by Cassini and identified fragments of large, complex organic molecules containing hundreds of atoms originating from Saturn's icy moon. Cassini had previously detected smaller, more common organic molecules at Enceladus. The scientists say the existence of these large complex molecules, along with hydrothermal activity on the moon, supports a theory that a massive liquid water ocean below the icy crust of Enceladus may provide a habitable environment for life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we talk with a prominent American diplomat about the U.S. relationship with North Korea. President Donald Trump has expressed his concern over the fate of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who has been missing since entering the Saudi consulate in Istanbul October 2nd.
We're demanding everything. We want to see what's going on here. That's a bad situation. And frankly, the fact that it's a reporter, you could say in many respects, it brings it to a level. It's a very serious situation for us and for this White House. We do not like seeing what's going on.
Turkey suspects Khashoggi was murdered. Saudi Arabia has called that baseless and has agreed to allow Turkey to inspect the consulate. The Washington Post, citing intelligence sources, said Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman ordered an operation targeting Khashoggi, who has been critical of Saudi policies. A U.S. State Department spokesman said the U.S. had no advance knowledge of any threat against Khashoggi, who fled his native land a year ago and resided in the U.S. Michael Fishbach, a history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty this matter will add strain to a complicated relationship among Turkey, Sunni Arab states, and the U.S. as they try to maintain a common alliance against Iran.
In many ways, obviously, the United States and Saudi Arabia are allies. Turkey and Saudi Arabia, there's tremendous Saudi investment in Turkey. They both are positioning themselves as Arab leaders of the Sunni Arab Middle East, to some degree along with Egypt. But yet their mutual ties, that is, between the Saudis and the Turks, have been strained over Saudi Arabia's relentless criticisms and attacks on the Gulf state of Qatar. The Turks actually sent troops to Qatar to prevent any kind of Saudi invasion. So I think the big picture is that as the United States in particular, and as well Saudi Arabia, are trying to coordinate an international bulwark against Iran, that this spat, a very serious spat that's resulting from this disappearance, notably between Saudi Arabia and Turkey, but also now dragging in the United States, could put serious pressures on that alliance against Iran.
Could this interrupt U.S.-Saudi relations?
Well, neither the United States nor the Saudis want that to happen. It certainly is a very serious problem for the Trump administration. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has particularly close ties with the Saudi crown prince, who many speculate is behind this, whatever the this is, if it's a disappearance, if it's a murder. Trump's first visit abroad as president was to Saudi Arabia, and his own Trump companies have a lot of business in Saudi Arabia. So for both personal and diplomatic reasons, not to mention things like oil, joint U.S.-Saudi efforts to contain Iran, neither the United States nor the Saudis want this to explode into a major brouhaha.
What could Saudi Arabia possibly have gained by either Mr. Khashoggi's disappearance, his kidnapping, abduction, or murder?
He was not merely a critic, but a critic from a well-placed family in Saudi Arabia, someone who formerly was fairly cozy with the ruling elites. I mean, in some ways, he's like a defector. In a sense, a defector from the leadership ranks, an insider, if you will, spilling the beans. We also need to consider that, according to press reports, the crown prince is notoriously thin-skinned and averse to criticism. And I think, finally, the fact that Khashoggi, unlike other Arab journalists, is very well known in the West, and notably hobnobs with some very important people in Washington, well-known journalists, foreign policy analysts. He's not just some lonely blogger somewhere criticizing the Saudi government. He's well-placed. And I think for all of those reasons, there was a particular desire of the Saudis to see him silenced.
Michael Fishbach, history professor at Randolph-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. The relationship between the United States and North Korea has been evolving since Donald Trump became U.S. president. He met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore in June and intends to hold a similar meeting in the future. Christopher Hill is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea. He was asked by VOA Steve Miller in Seoul, South Korea, to give his perception of the current landscape in Asia regarding Pyongyang.
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. And I think, first of all, with respect to North Korea, the whole six-party process seems to have broken down. And the Trump administration seems to prefer to do this bilaterally and then inform the others afterwards. It, frankly, it remains to be seen whether this is really going to work. Secondly, we have a new government in South Korea. And that government in South Korea seems very anxious to move ahead on so-called peninsula issues, on trying to normalize relations on the peninsula. And the issue is, can that go forward, and it's been going forward pretty rapidly, in the absence of progress on denuclearization? So there's some tension in how that will sort itself out. And then another issue, of course, is China. The U.S. has really kind of thrown the book at China over some longstanding trade and intellectual property rights issues. And I would say the U.S.-China relationship is going through some rough patches right now, meaning that it's need to kind of coordinate with China on North Korea. So a lot of headwinds, if you will, and we'll see how we come out of this.
Now, you brought up the six-party talks, which you were involved with. A while back, Kim Jong-un called the process broken, not going anywhere. They've been stalled for a long time. Some people have said, including Moon Jae-in, has said that this leader-to-leader approach is something new and why things are moving forward. But at the same time, you get these agreements like the Singapore summit where it's language that looks nice on paper, but it's short on details, and then you have to wait later for working-level meetings to actually hash things out. I mean, giving the stalled process that we've seen in the past almost decade now, what's your take on at least trying something new?
Look, always good to try new things. But I think I have a little trouble with the notion that somehow these leader-to-leader talks are really working, because I don't see any real movement in the North Korean position with respect to denuclearization. They've said they agree with it, but it sounds like an agreement in theory that is something that over the course of time they might or might not do. But I'm not seeing any specific real follow-up on these things. I think part of the problem, at least with respect to the U.S. participation in leader-to-leader talks, especially with North Korea, I think part of the problem is the U.S. is just so ill-prepared as it goes into these meetings, and now we're going to have a second summit coming up. And there doesn't seem to be a real effort to make clear, you know, what we are trying to achieve in these summits. And I think the real disadvantage of Singapore was, you know, a lot of buildup to this event, and then a piece of paper that came out of it, which was far weaker than papers we've had in the past. So it's not at all clear that things are moving.
In terms of moving, you bring up an interesting thing because, you know, if you look at the language coming out of North Korea and South Korea with their joint declarations, it's a lot of rehashing of what was previously said.
Yes.
If you look at the language coming out of the United States, sometimes it's very conflicting because on one side you have the president saying, hey, we want to make a deal, denuclearization is going to happen, but at the same time it's the old United States line. Sanctions will remain in place until full denuclearization. So with those conflicting messages, what kind of challenges does that present?
I think it presents a lot of challenges. I mean, the U.S. has made very clear that the U.S. supports a process that would lead to denuclearization. But at the same time, the president's saying that we're not going to give any sanctions relief until North Korea does everything. Well, I'll leave it to others to determine the practicality of that, but certainly I don't think North Korea is going to take measures to denuclearize in the absence of measures coming from the U.S.
Christopher Hill, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea, he spoke in Seoul with VOA's Steve Miller. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is International Edition. A superstar performer releases a new single as she accepts an award for career achievement. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins me with the latest.
We're going to play a brand new song from the incomparable Taylor Swift, who at only 28 years of age, she has already set a new American Music Award record by winning 4 more, bringing her total to 23 records now, 23 awards, which only Whitney Houston had done before her as a female artist, and Michael Jackson at 24 is the record holder of all time. But Taylor's only 28. So there's a good chance she'll top even Michael Jackson's record. The last time she was on the American Music Awards was 3 years ago, but this past week she was in Los Angeles to open up the American Music Awards with a brand new song off the Reputation album, which I'm going to spotlight for today on International Edition. So with your permission, let's check out I Did Something Bad.
I never trust a narcissist, but they love me. So I play them like a violin, and I make it look oh so easy. Cause for every lie I tell them, they tell me 3. This is how the world works, now all he thinks about is me. I can feel the flames on my skin, crimson red paint on my lips. If a man talks shit, then I owe him nothing. I don't regret it one bit, cause he had it coming.
So has she recorded this recently, or is this just a new single off?
Well, it's a new song off of her Reputation album. The Reputation album's been out a while. She has been previewing some new music on her tour as well. So she's got something in the works already anyway. But she's currently on tour for the Reputation album, which won an American Music Award. And she got the big award of the night at the American Music Awards for Artist of the Year. So congratulations to her. She got 3 other awards as well. The Artist of the Year award was the last one of the night. And when she came up on stage to accept the award from Lenny Kravitz, she threw in another little political push to go out and register to vote for the United States midterm elections that are coming up November 6th. She did that about a week ago and created a lot of buzz on the internet, and she's endorsed a couple of Democratic candidates in the midterm election in the Congress for Tennessee, which is where she's a registered voter. And in doing so, the registered voter number has increased.
Huh.
There was an uptick. So it was a gamble because Taylor Swift is typically not political. You don't hear her say political things, but she did not only in social media, but on stage last night. And it seems to be, you know, there's getting a response to it because she has such widespread influence throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is a role model. She always has been and continues to be. The album is called Reputation. Another thing about Taylor Swift you might be interested to hear. We don't typically think of her as an actress. She's been in a couple of films, very small roles. She's going to have a larger role in the upcoming film version of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Broadway musical, Cats. Taylor herself is a cat lover. She talks about Olivia and Meredith, her two big cats that she loves, and posts on social media all the time. But this time she's going to star in a musical. So far, the only other cast member that's been announced so far is Jennifer Hudson. We don't know anything beyond that. And Jennifer Hudson said recently in an interview, she doesn't have any cats. So maybe she needs to get one.
Maybe Taylor can get her one.
Maybe Taylor can get one for her. Taylor, by the way, is dating a British actor. She has a thing for people from England, from Europe. She's currently dating an actor whose name is Joe Alwyn. He did an interview in a British magazine recently, and he finally touched on the relationship, and he basically said, everybody knows who I'm seeing, and I'm trying to keep this low-key and as private as possible. Please respect us. But the two of them are very much in love, and this has been a long-term thing for her. And, you know, she's dated a couple of, as I said, British actors and American actors and singers.
Well, and I think she kind of wants to keep this one quiet because some of her previous relationships got a lot of publicity, and they didn't work out.
Yes, and they end with a song, too.
Yes, that's right.
Remarkably. But Taylor Swift, new music, I Did Something Bad. She opened up the show with that song, wearing a black leather outfit, sitting at the piano, then getting up and dancing. She did a great job. It's a new Taylor Swift. You know, she's been on the scene for about 14 years since her first album when she was country music.
Right.
We've all forgotten she transitioned from country to pop, and she's done a great job with it, and she's selling 60,000 tickets every single night for her Reputation Stadium tour. So I love Taylor Swift. I had her on Border Crossings. She's a very nice person, and she's the subject of our international edition today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
They say I did something bad. Oh, it feel so good.
That's Taylor Swift singing I Did Something Bad. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.